Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the January episode of City Talks. This month, we'll be discussing the different and changing relationships that cities have with their nation states across the world. Before we get into that, I'm joined by my colleagues Alexandra Jones and Paul Swinney to get their perspectives on how the city's agenda will play out in 2017. If 2016 was the year when big decisions about the future of the UK were taken, 2017 will be the year when the implications and consequences of those decisions become clearer. Alex, starting with you, how do you think the change in rules informing global politics and global economics, along with the continued mistrust of the elite and politicians, and obviously Brexit, will affect UK cities over the coming year?
Well, Brexit and international politics will dominate. What we've got is a year in which almost everything will be seen through the prism of Brexit. How will this affect international negotiations? Some of domestic policy will be seen that way as well, and I think it might squeeze out time for other issues like devolution. So you've got very big issues. Trump is coming in the US. I think that's set to increase protectionism potentially. You've got big elections in France and Germany, it might do the same. All of these things will change the rules for international trade and for the way in which actually cities are working day to day. So that big picture will dominate. And some of those issues of trust, you're seeing it in the US, you're going to see it in France and Germany, you saw it here with Brexit, trust in politicians and whether they will deliver on their promises, I think will be a big theme through the year.
Paul, give us a sense as to how the big issues around the nature of the economy are likely to play out over the next 12 months.
Well, it's fascinating to see, isn't it? I think what's happened over the last 12 months in terms of politics, referendum here, what's happened in the US, is that there's been a real theme there about nationalism and trying to protect the domestic economy and about trying to spread growth across the country. Now, of course, there's real tensions there because what we've seen is that globalisation has had its impact over the last 100 years. Some places have benefited much more from globalisation than others. I think some have really grabbed hold of the benefits, whereas some have probably been hit harder by some of the what may be perceived as the disbenefits of globalisation or loss of jobs, inability to attract in new jobs. There's a real tension there, isn't there? You know, it's growing the pie of the national economy doesn't necessarily mean that the distribution is that spread across the country. We've seen that, and we see that in our data all of the time. But I think the big challenge there, particularly for industrial strategies, is, well, how do you balance that? How do you balance the national priorities against trying to get a greater sort of distribution of growth across the country? It's very, very difficult, and I think there are some elements where we see particularly our biggest cities really punching below their weight. That has to change, I think, for the good of the national economy. But there's a bigger challenge there about places that perhaps are a little bit isolated, very small, perhaps away from big urban areas. What do you do about them? That's much less clear, and I think there's some very difficult sort of policy choices and very hard policy recommendations to come up with around that.
And I think that's where the trust issue will really resonate. People will be looking to see, how do you solve that? And I think mayors, huge issue coming up in the year, there's a real opportunity there actually to generate some more trust. These mayors, it's a new role, they have an opportunity to deliver in local areas tangible things that people can see. And I think for the political parties, there's a real opportunity to reconnect to the electorate. For Labour, it's a chance to have very high profile people talking to the nation as well as locally. For the Conservatives, it's a chance to connect with an urban agenda that they've struggled to connect with in recent years. So I think there's a big opportunity for those mayors to tackle some of this stuff head on and do it at a level where you can make a difference, because the city regions, we know, will be vital to driving growth in the years ahead. I think the challenge facing those mayors is establishing themselves, getting in their wins, quick wins, doing things quickly, as well as having a long-term plan. And I think the fact that national government is busy, it might mean you don't get as much time for kind of pushing that devolution agenda on. It might mean they actually start chucking stuff wholesale at mayors because they don't have time to deal with things. And if those mayors can establish themselves, there might be an opportunity there for devolution to really ramp it up again.
Yeah, it's difficult to work out how the pressures of Brexit will influence and drive the sort of national policy agenda. As you say, it could be squeezed out, or it could actually give it a significant boost. Just don't know yet, do we?
It's really difficult to tell. I think the industrial strategy is going to be critical to all of this, because that's the domestic answer to Brexit. It's about how you support growth, how you really make sure that this is a strategy that works for the whole country. And I think in that, given Greg Clark's interest in devolution, there is an opportunity to keep pushing this agenda. From an economic perspective, we know how important it is.
Yeah.
So difficult to know yet, but I think I'm certainly hopeful that we'll see some movement, whether it's nationally driven or locally driven. I think there is a question.
Yeah. And from our analysis of our cities and how they're performing poor, what do we want the industrial strategy to be doing and thinking about? And what are some of the tensions or issues that it's going to need to deal with in what appears to be a fairly extensive process of negotiation or consultation when we get some kind of green paper or white paper, hopefully early in 2017?
Well, historically, what we've seen with industrial strategy is it's a focus on sectors and specific sectors. And the big problem with that, I think, is that you tend to see, or we've seen in the past, politicians have tended to go for more pet projects. Mm. And, you know, it's littered with very obvious failures, like sort of the lame ducks of the 1970s and things like that. I think what our research shows is that increasingly the UK is specialised in more knowledge-based type activities. Increasingly they're clustering within cities and city centres in particular. And I think therefore what we want to be seeing is a focus on place, which actually looks at the fundamentals of a place and thinks about, are these places attractive to business investment? If not, why not? You know, and you're then into the realms of thinking about skills, about planning, about transport and those sorts of things. And I think our view on this is that if we get that element right, then you're supporting growth in any sector, wherever that sector may be in the future, because we have no idea where growth is actually going to come from. All we know is that place is important and we think it's going to become increasingly important. But the beauty there of that approach is that it is supporting, you know, growth in any sector where it may come from, as opposed to perhaps the more specific sector approach, which is trying to pick out individual sector or sectors, trying to put your hat on those sectors, but we have no idea about how that's going to help, whether they're right sectors to grow, to support, whether they will grow in the future. And it implicitly ignores sectors elsewhere in the economy as well.
It gives us a chance to think about the different roles and relationships and contributions that different places can make, Alex, doesn't it, I think?
It does, I think. And I mean, it goes back to the point that Paul was making about really thinking about how do you ensure economic growth and you ensure it's inclusive. Actually thinking properly about the roles of different places, playing to their strengths and thinking about how you invest in the people who live in them, making sure they've got the skills to adapt to what will be a very fast-changing world. We've seen that in recent decades. It's set to continue. I think that will be absolutely critical. And I think that question, how do you make the most of different people and places, should be at the heart of the thinking about growth in the year to come.
Yeah. And final thoughts on, as you say, Brexit is the defining policy agenda. It's essentially a policy agenda of nation states talking to other nation states individually and collectively about their relationship going forward. How do cities need to play into that space? But how do they also try to break out of nation-to-nation conversations? What do they need to be doing? Alex?
I think they need to be bold about their role in the world. What you're seeing internationally is more and more cities saying, as national government gets mired in ideological discussions, in trade negotiations, we need to set out who we are, what we're good at, and establish relationships with cities around the world. You've got a global parliament of mayors now. You've got lots of international leagues of cities talking together. I think some of the best cities are thinking about almost a foreign policy. What can we focus on? What are our goals? Who do we connect with? They've got individual relationships they're nurturing with cities around the world, and they're looking to show they're open, they're ready to do business, and they welcome investment and talent from around the world.
And the 2017 edition of Cities Outlook, Paul, will talk a little bit about the existing trade relationships that cities have already with different places across the globe.
Yes, we've been beavering away over the last couple of months creating estimates for exports for every city across Britain. We're quite excited about what we've got to show, and I'll give a detail on, I think, what cities export, where they export it to, and what is the role and importance of exports within sort of, within their wider economy. So hopefully it provides lots of great detail on an area that we don't know a great deal about to this point.
2017 certainly will be a busy year again for our cities and for the UK at large. We will wait with eager interest to see how all this plays out.
My thanks to Alex and Paul. The centralised relationship the UK government has with cities up and down the country, and the need for this to change, is at the heart of many of the economic and policy challenges that the country is currently grappling with. Brexit, devolution, industrial strategy, all have this perspective and this issue at their heart. To inform how this relationship might change in the coming years, this episode of City Talks is going to explore how cities and their national governments across the globe are reorganising and updating their relationships to respond to global, national and local economic, political and demographic challenges and opportunities. Joining me is Greg Clark and Tim Moonan. Greg is Global Advisor to Cities, a board member at the Centre for Cities and a Global Fellow at Brookings. His latest book is called Global Cities, A Short History, which is published by Brookings. Tim is a researcher and advisor on governance, leadership and strategy at the Business for Cities. And Greg and Tim are the co-authors of a book called World Cities and Nation States. Links to both publications are available on the City Talks webpage at centreforcities.org. Tim, I want to start with a quote.
The extent to which the long wave of global urbanisation will, in hindsight, come to be viewed as a success for human development will, in no small part, be down to how well nation states and their world cities team up and work together. Just unpick that quote for me a little bit, and particularly give us a sense as to why the relationship between world cities and nation states is so pivotal, so important in the 21st century.
We talk a lot about the rise of the age of cities. We're in the new century of cities, and this century of cities is displacing or replacing the century of the nation state, which we really understand the 20th century to be. But it's as these two centuries are kind of overlapping, this sort of the frictions between the fact that we, this world of global cities that we speak about so often, is inheriting a lot of the kind of identities, the organizing principles, the practices that were very embedded in the nation state era. And how it is then that world cities, despite the fact that we think so much potential is in them, how are they going to actually negotiate their way? How are they going to find new powers, gain new fiscal independence? How are they going to manage their own growth challenges? And at the same time, how are they going to agree with their nation state a kind of mutual deal that's going to be seen to have kind of mutual benefits for both?
Yeah, Greg, one.
Well, I think a lot is said at the moment about the rise of a new league of city-states. And when Tim and I examined this proposition, we realised that less than 1% of the cities in the world have anything like the powers of a state. So the notion of a rise of a league of city-states seems to us to be not quite the right description. We're in a time when expectations of cities have risen and the promise of global urbanisation is there, but the tools, the governance, the fiscal systems, the powers that cities need to make the most of global urbanisation does not seem to us to be in place.
No.
And therefore, in this negotiated space that Tim's talking about, where cities have to negotiate with national governments to both borrow powers and competences on the one hand, to use national policies effectively, and to guide the right kinds of devolutions and reforms, is very critical to how this this century of cities unfolds. Mm. So the point really is to focus attention back on this critical relationship, rather than to focus attention, for example, on global urban diplomacy or networks of cities and their roles in influencing transnational policies and other things like that. We think that the relationship between world cities and nation states may be more fundamental.
Yeah, and in the World Cities and Nation States book, you highlight 12 world cities ranging from London, New York, Paris, Seoul, Shanghai, interestingly Mumbai. But in your Global Cities, A Short History, Greg, you remind us that these are the latest wave. These are the latest versions of world cities, which essentially have been around for a very long time. So just give us a sense as to working backwards, almost how we've got to where we've got to now and what the history of global cities says.
Yes, well, Brookings is doing a series of short histories to coincide with their 100th year anniversary, their centenary. They asked me to write this book about global cities, delighted to do that. And so the point was, how do you write a short history of global cities? You could start in 1975 with Peter Hall and his observations about world cities and globalization and cities. Or you could say, well, what's the phenomena behind that, and where does that have its origin? So in fact, for this book, we went all the way back 4,500 years to the origins of cities and trade, observing that, as it were, trade seems to have two big effects on cities. One, it drives increased connectivity. Mm-hmm. Two, it drives innovation, whether that's innovation in finance or in law or in the role of exchange, or it drives innovation in terms of how cities organize themselves. And that both of these things, connectivity and innovation driven by trade, promote urbanization.
Yes.
So the links between trade and urbanization are very clearly established. And then looking back both to, 10 different cycles or waves of globalization and cities, we sort of observe five common things. The book's not a theory of global cities, I should say, but we do observe that trade and connectivity seem to be part of this.
Yep.
Openness, diversity, entrepreneurial populations are another part, because obviously they're attracted by trade and connectivity. A stress on innovation and influence, inventing the new tools of exchange and trying to influence the conditions and the rules of exchange becomes very key. The discovery and the servicing of new markets, both within known borders and beyond them. And then the fifth thing seems to be the ability of these cities to take advantage of geopolitical opportunity when it arises. So what we observed is that these five things seem to recur and recur. And in fact, although we're not trying to define what global cities are, you see the same five things, of course, in the globalising cities of today.
And what's been the dynamic where, over time, where the cities have, I suppose, led their countries or their nations, even before they had nation states, but nevertheless were different from, you know, the locations in which they were placed? And how has that changed over time? I'm just thinking now about, you know, where we are on the back of Brexit, on the back of, you know, a US election where urban to rural and big to small were big factors about the difference of our things. But just give us that kind of global sense, that historical sense as to where cities were ahead or where cities were behind the nations or the countries in which they were in.
Well, for much of the 4,500 year history that's contained in the book, of course, the nation state does not exist.
No.
This is a phenomena of the last 300-400 years in one way or another. And most of the groups of cities that we observe, of course, are associated with empires, they're associated with conquests, they're associated with language groups, they're associated with different kinds of religious expansion. So whether you're interested in, you know, the 500 AD and the Royal Roads, or the Silk Roads of 400 BC and onwards to that, or whether you're thinking about the Hanseatic League, the cities of the Ming Dynasty, or even, you know, the transatlantic trade route that emerged during the early century, if you like, of the British Empire. All of these things have something particular in common, which is that there's an organizing power that seeks to create the potential for trade through better connectivity. That connectivity requires these hubs to grow. Those hubs then promote urbanization and become the key cities. But it's the networks and the groups of cities that emerge and grow together that seem to us to be key. So if you like, the idea at the very heart of this is that it was never about an individual city, though Antwerp or Baghdad or Alexandria may pop out of the history as being interesting. It was always about systems of cities in one way or another. Now, coming back to your question, Andrew, you know, there were always jealousies, there were always challenges, there was always observations that, if you like, these trading cities throughout the centuries seem to be places that were the winners from the trade activities. And there were, of course, losers. It's simply that prior to the nation state, the advocacy that came on behalf of the losers wasn't the kind of democratic discourse we see today through an open media or a political process. The voice of the losers was expressed in military activities, in spoiling campaigns, in conquests and other things. Yeah. So there's always been opposition to the globalising city model. It's just that it expressed itself differently in those days.
And what's the timescale now for thinking about you know, the relationship, the tensions, the mutual interrelationships between the modern nation state and the modern world city, Tim. I mean, you know, has this really begun to emerge and evolve over the last 200 years, 300 years? You know, where are we now?
Well, I think if you think about the 19th century, there was a general sense that the major engines of growth were, once again, cities. And in general, the sense in which the policy of at the national level and the interests of the cities were predominantly aligned. And even looking ahead after 1945, there was still a sense in which there were a strong degree of alignment between national and city policy. And what you then begin to see happen in the post-war era is a sense when national governments nearly across the board attempt to redistribute, reallocate growth away from the big cities, and in a part of a sort of a policy of equalisation, as it was often called. And what we've seen in many of the examples in our book is how these policies have increasingly been recognised to have been either failures or to have created distortions that have subsequently required addressing. And that's where we're roughly up to now in terms of nation states are beginning to address at different speeds and at different scales some of the distortions, some of the externalities that have arisen from the attempts to curb the growth. Yeah. Of the bigger cities.
Yeah.
And you could argue, I think, that nearly all nation states are somewhere on a journey from pursuing what we might call old type regional policies, where we sought to redistribute or reallocate economic activity away from the major centres to others, a set of policies that have, in most cases, not been effective, towards a new set of policies where there might be some other elements where, firstly, devolution is part of the story, helping all cities, regions, metropolitan areas to become more empowered in order to be both more motivated and more able to pursue their own development.
Yeah.
Secondly, the idea of systems of cities, better connecting places as a way of tackling inter-regional disparities. And then the third idea, of course, which is to focus on a set of policies which are much more productivity and indeed trade oriented, rediscovering, as it were, the mercantilist capability of cities and really supporting them. So most nations are on a journey between that old paradigm and this new paradigm, and the new paradigm is more subtle and sophisticated in some nations than in others.
Yeah.
But you can probably chart nearly every member of the OECD and where they are on that journey.
We'll pick up on some of the other aspects of the book, but just follow that thread for a second. Interesting to get your thoughts on, I mean, a lot of this was happening when, you know, global trade was expanding. Obviously, more countries, more cities were being drawn into global networks, whether it's talent or whether it's trade or whether it's investment. And not to overplay it, because in the long run, you know, we have to be careful about short-run effects and short-run issues. But there has been a sort of hint over the last, you know, 24, 36 months of, you know, globalization and a rebuke to it, and some nations being, you know, more explicit about that. I wonder what that might do to exactly the sorts of policies that you were just laying out, Greg.
We might observe three, maybe more, types of globalizing cities that have distinctive characteristics and very particular kinds of challenges. Put it very simply, the 10 million plus cities that are the leading gateways of the emerging economies, the Shanghais, the Mumbais, the Sao Paulos, very specific set of challenges for them around making an economic case for the global city and tackling the problems of urban inequality and urban quality. The second group, the established world cities, the Londons, the New Yorks, the Hong Kongs, the Parises, the Tokyos and others, where the transition from, as it were, a financial services dominated model towards something else, both the new set of corporates and new technologies and other emerging sectors is key, but also the deep challenge of inequality emerging there and unaffordability and the relationship with their nation states and the extent to which they're seen as centrifugal or centripetal forces in their national economies.
Yeah.
And then the third group that we would probably call the new world cities or the new global cities, which are a group of cities that are sort of 5 million and below, the Sydneys, the Barcelonas, the Tel Avivs, the San Diegos, where this group of cities are trying a different model, which is to combine high quality of life in a relatively managed and well facilitated metropolitan area, with specialisation in two or three of the newly globalising sectors, which have been enabled by the new technologies. And I think the issue is that the rebuke, as you put it, towards the global city model is rather different depending upon which kind of global city you're talking about.
Okay.
And so therefore, for example, the Shanghais, the Dubais, the Mumbais, enjoying, as it were, national state support because they're absolutely critical to the way that that national economy engages, perhaps for the first time or perhaps in a new cycle, with the global economy. Yeah. Whereas the Hong Kongs, the New Yorks and the Londons suffering terrible pressure, of course, around inequality, lack of affordability, air quality, all of these other challenges. Yeah. Whereas the New World city models, often these cities have a kind of hero status within their country. Think of Tel Aviv in Israel, or think of Sydney in Australia, where for the first time these countries are creating a place which has the potential to be a world leader in a certain set of newly traded sectors.
Yeah.
So the picture's quite uneven, actually, Andrew.
Yeah.
And it's only with the cities that we focus on in the World Cities and Nation States story where I think you can see this challenge being at its most precise.
Tim, I mean, add to what Greg was saying there, but I thought one of the many interesting elements or ways of thinking that you lay out in the World Cities Nation States book is trying to understand both the cities, in a sense, and their, you know, the characteristics as you both laid out, but actually the influence then of the nation state and the organisation of the nation state, and how that in itself, and you identify three sorts of structures or ways that the nations they work. Just lay out a little bit what they are and give us an example of some of the cities, and because I'd be fascinated to get into a little bit more detail about how each of those plays out.
But, so know, we really identify three types of city. The first type being the one that we are familiar with in the UK, the unitary system where there's a central government, a single higher tier of government. Then there's a second type, which is the federal system, where the principal relationship that the world city has is with the state government or the provincial government, and the relationship with the federal tier is a little bit more remote. And then there's a third kind of city where perhaps the world city or some, or perhaps more than one world city in that country has been given some kind of special status, special designation.
Yeah.
And that provides perhaps particular fiscal powers, particular legislative powers for those cities. And our perspective from looking at all those 12 cities, so for example, it's London, Paris, Seoul and Tokyo being the ones with the central government as a very close mediator of affairs,
yeah,
is that those countries in particular and those cities have seen some progress in the last 20 or 30 years in different ways and in different at different speeds.
Yeah.
But you can certainly see attempts, for example, to improve the metropolitan governance system in those cities. You can see attempts to try and create more predictable infrastructure project funding. You can see efforts to agree some kind of deals regarding fiscal independence or fiscal devolution,
yeah,
and we can,
yeah,
we'll come on to that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But just briefly on the other two types, I mean, yeah, the federal relationship, in general, we find it's more problematic in general how it's been emerging on average, although you do see signs of positive development, for example, in Canada with Toronto increasingly being recognised as a global city and a national strategy for cities beginning to re-emerge. But in general, there's a sense that the federal tier, even though it's more remote, even though it has less responsibility for those big cities, that they need to show more leadership, whether it's on a kind of big national urban policy level or whether it's on a big infrastructure investment or kind of sectoral investment that really focuses on the different specialisms of the different cities. So there's a big challenge there for how federal systems respond to this new challenge.
Yeah.
And then finally, on terms of the special special status cities, as we call them, perhaps one of the most distinctive tensions
these
are places like Shanghai,
Hong Kong
is a kind of special autonomous region, and Moscow is a sort of special city along with St. Petersburg in Russia.
Yeah.
One of the challenges that's beginning to emerge, although they've been very effective at supporting agglomeration in these big cities, there are also the trade-offs that then occur as the other regions become significantly denuded of their talent and their assets? And how do you manage a situation where there's such a polarization between the big city and other regions? That's increasingly going to be a big concern in those areas.
Yeah. And the impetus for change, you know, the starting point for renegotiation, is it everywhere is individual in a sense you have to kind of really figure that out? Or can you see that actually, you know, unitary states have begun to, you know, they've been the ones taking the lead, or, you know, in federal states, it, you know, it's much more the cities. But give us a sense as to where that impetus for change, that demand for a renegotiated settlement, where's that coming from?
Well, I think in the first group, the sort of the unitary nation states, that demand for a resettlement is coming from two places. On the one hand, it's coming from the world cities themselves that realise that they're dealing with exceptional levels of unanticipated growth and that the institutional framework that they have doesn't prepare them to anticipate growth, to invest in advance, to bring forward new housing, new infrastructure. They have a nation state system that tends to lag the growth model. On the other hand, as Tim was observing, within those nations, pressure for change is also coming from outside the big metropolitan cities, where the rest of the nation state, the second tier cities, the rural areas, are increasingly concerned about the sucking in effect of these big cities. So that's one group. In the second group that Tim was talking about, the federal states, what's very interesting here, we're talking about, of course, Mumbai, New York, Sao Paulo, Toronto here, is that in the case of Mumbai, Sao Paulo and Toronto, this is a national government perceiving an opportunity to insert itself into a global system of exchange and needing a location through which that happens. So the Indian government has really had a policy of benign neglect towards both Mumbai and Delhi for a long period of time. The states have been pretty ineffective at governing these global cities.
Yeah.
But the Indian government has woken up to the fact that actually, if Mumbai and Delhi don't succeed, there are problems for India. So things are beginning to happen there. And a similar train of thought is just beginning with Sao Paulo and Rio in Brazil. And as Tim explained, it's already happening in Toronto and in Canada. So that's interesting. And then in this third group, as Tim says, the special status cities, Shanghai, Moscow, Hong Kong, pressure for change is coming on the one hand from business elites within those cities that want those cities to be more competitive with the other global cities. So the business elites in Moscow and Shanghai in particular, seeking to position their cities as competitors to Hong Kong and London and New York and others. And on the other hand, as Tim, I think, explains very well, there's a huge pressure coming from the regional disparities. And in those countries, the regional disparities are the greatest. So that, if you like, there's a sort of an anecdotal observation here that the cities that are individually most empowered in a way that separates them from the other regions and cities within their countries, those that are given special federal status, seem to have the effect both of going through their own development path, which is quite understandable, but exacerbating the regional disparities and inequalities.
I wonder if we can say anything about the capacity of the city to respond. My sense would be, you tell me otherwise, would be where the impetus for change is coming from the cities themselves, their ability to articulate what they need and to be able to be able to deal with those changes would be better than if the national government is deciding that these cities are now very important, but actually there was the degree to which those cities are able have the capacity, the resources, the expertise to deal with that.
Yeah.
Is that fair, right or not?
It's absolutely fair, I think, Andrew. And let me put it in, I think, what would be the most striking way that one possibly can. If you were to take the 12 cities in the report and try to plot them on a spectrum of levels of self-government, you would find, of course, that Hong Kong and Singapore are way up near the top, almost 100% self-government in Singapore, probably near to 75% in Hong Kong, notwithstanding debates about the future. You would find that the federally empowered cities are up near the kind of 50% position. But then you would find that the other cities would be much less empowered. And interestingly, you'll find different positions. For example, New York is a relatively empowered city, but within a state that doesn't necessarily love it. And this gives big problems for its region and its metropolitan area, which covers three states at least. On the other hand, you find that these cities that exist within the nation states, the centralised states, particularly London and Paris, you might observe, have relatively low levels of competence, whether you're measuring it in terms of finances and tax and financial powers, or whether you're measuring it in terms of legislative powers, even if they have capable transport authorities and they have good land use planning policies, they have great difficulties in augmenting their own toolbox. So the observation would be, to put it at its simplest, that if the challenge is dealing with population growth and a changing economy, actually it's the Singapores and the Hong Kongs, followed by the Seouls and the Shanghais, who've been most able to use fiscal, financial and land use planning tools to invest what we might call aggressively in the infrastructure systems needed to create a platform for growth and to manipulate land uses more effectively to accommodate rapidly increasing housing supply.
So that's really interesting. So just to be clear and get Tim's perspective on as well. So just push this a little bit more, because we hear this conversation around, you know, the autonomy and capacity to almost use that autonomy wisely. From, if I'm right, what you're saying is, from your observations, that those cities that are most autonomous or have, you know, higher degrees of self-governance, however we define it, also have higher levels of expertise in order to manage and use that autonomy and that fiscal responsibility wisely. I mean,
capacity and capability.
Capacity and capability is directly related to their abilities.
And of course that's mediated by the geographical boundaries of institutions. Yeah. So New York City is a very capable city and it has powers as a city that are fantastic.
Yeah.
But the New York metropolitan area is relatively disempowered and fragmented between warring states and different institutions. So it's much more difficult for New York City to develop a metropolitan approach.
Yeah.
On the other hand, as we know, London has acquired great metropolitan governance capabilities over the recent period of time, but still lacks the ability to use fiscal and financial tools on the scale that New York has them, and has no framework for addressing London's relationship with the greater southeast.
Yeah.
What I'd add to that is that for those cities that are in a relatively disempowered condition relative to the others that Greg's outlined, I think there's often an important role played by business and civic leadership to fill some of those gaps and to make sure that some of the policies are more coherent than one sometimes finds in more state-led and more empowered situations. So, for example, if we think about Tokyo, some of the recent national policies to try and improve the business climate in Tokyo and in some of the second cities have proved fairly ineffective at first and second goes. They're trying to refine it, but there has been a sense there has been a lack of private sector engagement in the development of those policies. You do see, whether it's in London or Toronto or New York, examples where business or civic leadership have played a really active role in filling governance vacuums, devising good strategic policies. So I would say that does kind of complicate that spectrum.
And one of the problems, of course, Andrew, is that in the most empowered cities, in this study, Singapore and Hong Kong, there does appear to be a trade-off between very high levels of public sector institutional capacities seeming to correspond with relatively low levels of business and civic engagement.
Yeah.
The more empowered the city government is, the more people expect city government to solve the problems, the less motivation there is for civic and business leadership to really play a role.
Yeah. Is there a relationship between, you know, I don't know crudely how urban the nation state is? You know, in a sense, part of the argument that you hear us make at Centre for Cities, others make it, is in essentially, you know, we are an urban country, you know, vast majority of people, the vast majority of economic activity takes place in, you know, in places, and they happen to be in urban areas. And, you know, I don't know, does that really matter as to then how the nation state interacts with and pays regard to the city?
Well, firstly, I think you've put your finger on the core conundrum at the heart of the book. And I'd summarise it this way, Andrew. On the one hand, it's easy to look at the devolution scenario as a kind of zero sum. Mm. The nation state gives up powers, the city acquires powers.
Yeah.
Actually, it's not like that.
No.
What you're looking for is a better set of territorial competences at both levels of government, so that cities and metropolitan areas become more empowered and nation states and federal governments become better at supporting and encouraging territorial policies on the one hand. So that's one conundrum. The other conundrum is getting the right balance between bespoke arrangements for individual cities and metropolitan areas, and on the other hand, thinking about the systems of cities and locations that a nation or a region has, and having appropriate policies for them. So if you like, there's a kind of perfect normative situation you're looking for here, where you have high levels of autonomy within metropolitan areas, and you have highly focused nation states and federal governments thinking about territorial policies well. On the other hand, you have the ability to customise arrangements for individual cities, and you have attention paid to the system of cities at the same time. That would be the ideal. And in a sense,
who's closest to the ideal?
Well,
you know, given your experiences, you clearly, you're outsiders in many respects to the UK and, you know, the peculiarities of this particular country. You observe the world. Be keen to get you where you think the balance is closest to the ideal, if there is such an ideal.
It's very difficult to answer that question because, of course, every country is different. Every system of cities is different. Every individual city is different. But if you look at the situation in Japan, the connectivity between the cities is very good.
Yeah.
The complementary specialization between them is good. The level of attention provided by the nation state to the cities is good, and the level of empowerment of individual cities is good.
Yeah.
So overall, you could say the Japanese model's pretty good. It's just that their economy is not working very well.
Yeah.
Right? And you could say something similar about South Korea, actually. You know, the South Korean government has for many years pursued a policy of trying to drive growth out of Seoul and into other centres, and has finally given up on that and has said, no, actually, we're going to let Seoul develop as a fantastic capital city, and we're going to focus attention on these specialised cities around it, whether it's Busan or Incheon or the others. And that's enabled, I think, a clear system of cities to really emerge in South Korea in a way it hadn't done before.
Yeah. I want to get your reactions and sort of reflections on the distortions that world cities exert, either on nation states. You know, you talk a little bit about in the book that, you know, there is a sense that world cities distort nation state policy and decision making preferences in favour of, often. That's the critique. So the distortion that they have on the nation state and how it decides to operate. And then related to that, you know, you hear a lot about the distortions caused by the world city on second or third tier cities. In a sense, you get into London grows, or New York grows, or Paris grows, but they grow at the expense of Manchester or Lyon or Chicago, or whatever their comparative set of cities are. I don't have much time for those sorts of arguments, but it'd be interesting to get your thoughts and what the book tells us about those distortions, how real they are, and how we counter them, and where we see examples where it has been countered. Tim,
Well, you're right. You've certainly explained some of the key distortions that are perceived and to a certain extent are real. And I think the most important of those, in terms of at least the perception and the political debate, are the investment favouritism that the world city has, in the sense that not only does public infrastructure investment and public investment in things like science or medicine or culture or sport tend to gravitate towards a big city, but also private co-investment is therefore enabled given the confidence to invest in the world cities rather than the smaller cities or other areas. But then you do also see the impacts of brain drain, as you mentioned, the bias of centralised decision-making and centralised financial systems, and the sense where the enterprise and entrepreneurship is more supported in and around the big cities because investors tend to locate near cities of where there's scale and liquidity. So there's definitely a sense in which all those factors are relevant in nearly all of these cities. But I would say that in some countries, those effects are less severe than in others. So a lot of people in France will argue that actually, despite Paris's relative success in France. Actually, many of the second cities have managed to retain more of their graduate talent. Mm-hmm. They have had seen more significant and stable and predictable investment over the last 30, 40 years. And that's why you don't see, well, we'll wait and see how things turn out next spring. But yeah. At the moment, the political reactions haven't yet been as severe in France.
Yeah, great.
Well, I think the obvious point to make here is that the challenge is that this is complex, and that one has to simultaneously hold in one's mind the distorting effect that Tim elucidated a moment or two ago with what's perceived to be the advantages of having a world city. Yeah. And the advantages, of course, are to do with connectivity, they're to do with gateway functions, they're to do with the ability of that city to host global activities that wouldn't otherwise come to that nation but would go to another global city, to do with productivity advantages, to do with the effect that the global city or the world city can have in pushing activities out to other parts of the nation. So the problem is, I think, Andrew, that nearly every formulation of this issue only formulates one half of the equation.
Yeah.
Either it focuses totally on the disadvantages of having a world city,
yeah,
or it focuses solely on the advantages of, yeah, having a world city.
Yeah.
And what we need to do if we're going to be serious about the future of cities is try to think about both things together.
Yeah.
But I think just to back up the point that Tim made, of course, when if you're in the UK, and Tim and I spend most of our time outside the UK, you often hear conversations about, you know, London's incredible dominance of the UK economy.
Yeah.
But anyone who's been to Sweden and understands Stockholm's role in the Swedish economy, or been to Argentina and seen the role that Buenos Aires plays there, or goes to South Korea and sees the role of Seoul there, London's dominance within the UK economy is not unparalleled in other nations in any sense. So we're not dealing with some kind of monster creature here, which is occasionally how it's described in the press. What we do have is a pressing requirement to understand the UK system of cities better.
Yeah.
And I think to put it in its most simple form, it seems to me that we have a system that has a couple of subsystems in it. One is the relationship between London and the cities in the greater southeast or the home counties and that set of complementary relationships.
Yeah.
Another thing is the cities in the north of England, where Manchester and Leeds and Liverpool and Newcastle and Sheffield and others have a set of systematic relationships that could be reinforced and invested in. You see some similar patterns, of course, in the Midlands and in the southwest of England and Wales. And you see emerging patterns and systems of cities in Scotland. And understanding these better and thinking about how to reinforce them so that places can both be competitive, cohesive, well-connected, complementary to each other, and so that these subsystems can reinforce each other is a pretty important thing to do in the UK.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure there's really been a serious effort to do that yet.
I think you're absolutely right. And as you say, in the peculiarities of London are not that peculiar when you take an international perspective. But they are slightly peculiar when you look at countries that we're often compared to. And the one, interestingly, not in the book, and I understand why, Germany being, you know, the classic, you know, this is the constant refrain, the constant response. But look, you know, Germany, it's got, you know, it's a much more competitive economy. It's much more spatially distributed economy. It doesn't have, you know, the big spikes that of London and elsewhere. You know, Berlin, 4% of the German economy, whereas ours, we're up to about a fifth or so. So I agree with you in a sense when we look broader and look at Buenos Aires and other places, but it does look and feel different. And you hear this all the time. If only we were more like Germany, or even if we were, you know, a little bit more like Italy, where, you know, Rome and Milan, you know, kind of, or Amsterdam and Rotterdam. What, you know, what's the response to that from an international perspective, you know, from your perspective?
Well, I would say that, as Greg mentioned earlier, we're all products of history. Every country is a product of history. And one has to remember in the German context, although we look at it in Europe and go, it is a model of how well-performing the second cities are. Actually, it's a very distinctive product of the post-war situation and Berlin's unique, you know, denouement of so much of its major institutions, major companies that fled to Munich and Frankfurt and other cities. So, actually, that kind of relative parity is a very distinctive historical product, and one cannot either hope for or imagine that having occurred in the UK. So if we think about the comparative, you know, what are the real comparatives with the UK? We're thinking Korea, to a certain extent, one might say Japan in terms of size of the major city relative to the others.
Yeah.
There aren't that many comparatives in Europe, France to a certain extent, and you know, Italy again isn't really a close comparator to the UK. So I would say relative to the real comparator cities globally, London's context is actually quite similar, and in many respects one should take heart from the fact that more progress has taken place. If we think about where London was in 1986 to where it is in 2016, a lot of progress is taking place in London, and now the challenge is really what's happening in the rest of the UK. And I think that there is a lot of reason for optimism.
So as we begin, we can begin to close, you know, drawn on the historical perspective that you take in the Global Cities book, give us a sense as to what the next wave of global cities, urbanisation, you know, what's it going to look like? Where might it, you know, where is it going to take place? And then I get some both reflections from you as a, you know, as outsiders that observe the world, you know, kind of final reflections on the UK and the sort of city versus, you know, the city and nation state discussions going on currently, where you think they might go next, and indeed where we might look for inspiration. And take the historical perspective first, Greg. Tell us about, you know, the next wave, what and where.
Well, I think we're in a very, very interesting time in terms of the global geography of cities and their connectivity and their relationship to flows of trade, capital, people, other things. And clearly we're coming into a period where rather than embracing multilateral trade agreements, we're going to have some retrenchment. So that's a kind of disruptor of the evolution of this global cities model that we've been talking about. But what's particularly interesting to me about the current model is that it seems, or the current cycle, it seems to me to be very distinctive to the last cycle. Mm-hmm. If the last cycle began sometime in the early 80s and ended sometime around 2008, 2009 with the global financial crisis, what you could say about that cycle very clearly is that was the cycle when financial services, professional services, media and information services globalized. And therefore, the cities that became the dominant global cities in that cycle were the cities that specialised in those sectors. Mm-hmm. And that was very clear. And so we knew that London and New York and Hong Kong and Paris and Tokyo and Singapore and a few others were part of that. This cycle, I think, is different for all sorts of reasons. The first reason is that, you know, what we've traditionally called the emerging markets are not just emerging, but they're fully emerged and they're very dominant players now, and the economic centres of gravity in the world have changed. Yeah. The cities associated with those markets, particularly I would suggest Shanghai and Beijing, but also, as we've been talking about, Mumbai and Delhi and Moscow and Sao Paulo and Rio and Buenos Aires and others, are going to be substantial players both in this cycle and in the next cycle. And then the second big change, of course, is this wave of new technologies, whether they're in clean tech and convergence, they're in life sciences and biotechnology, or they're in IT and digital. This set of technologies is enabling a new set of sectors to globalize. So on the one hand, healthcare and life sciences are now a global sector. On the other hand, digital media screen industries are a global sector. Convergence technologies and environmental sciences and materials science become globalizing sector. And I would argue, actually, the kind of traded urban services are now a global sector. Infrastructure, logistics, engineering, urban planning, architecture, design. So the point would be, Andrew, that if these are the globalizing sectors of these cycles, the question is, how many cities can specialize in these sectors and become global cities through that route? And what's interesting then about that is I think that does play to the opportunities for the Tel Avivs and the San Diegos and the Santiago de Chiles and the Sydneys and the Melbournes and a much wider group of cities to see themselves as having global leadership in one or two value chains associated with these particular sectors. So I think what this leads to is this, that we will have more different kinds of global cities in this cycle and in the next. We'll have a larger number of cities that consider themselves global leaders and will exercise leadership in certain sectors, underpinned by their universities and their business communities and their connectivity and others. And we will see intense competition both between these cities, so competition, for example, between Shanghai and Mumbai, or competition between Barcelona and Tel Aviv, just in the same way that we've seen competition between London and Hong Kong for IPO listings. But we'll also see these different types of cities competing with each other for specific kinds of niches. So you end up with a rather interesting conversation of, you know, how many global cities can the global economy sustain?
Yep.
The answer is clearly going to be that it's more than we've had in the last cycle. But understanding the answer to that question and understanding what it means to make it as a global city in this new cycle, and what it means to be part of a leading group, and what the benefits of that are, but also what disadvantages come with it, is going to be a bit of a quest for the global city scholars over the next 5 to 10 years.
Mm. Great. Tim, give us a sense as an observer of cities across the globe. Just give us an external perspective on, I suppose, the UK and where you think we're going to, you know, where we go next on, you know, in these sorts of debates and issues.
Well, all I would say is that the global map that Greg has just explained, I think, is going to become a reality in some form or another. And London will be a key part of that, no matter what. And I think we all should have confidence of that. Some of the scare stories or the crisis stories are a little bit unnecessary or overstated. And equally, I think that the roles of the leading second cities, the Manchesters, the Bristols, the Birminghams, will, in general, be looking positive.
Greg, your thoughts on the UK's context?
Well, maybe two things to say. That I think over the last 25 years, the drivers for devolving more power to cities have been principally around wanting our cities to recover economically, to become more competitive. I think the current cycle is much more about empowering our cities so that they can address two other very profound challenges. One is inequality, and in particular, you know, the divergence of incomes within cities. And city governments therefore need to be able to combine not just the tools of competitiveness, land use and infrastructure and things like that, but also health, housing, education, social care budgets. And that's why, of course, the Manchester devolution is such an interesting one, because it's a devolution that involves them acquiring the capability to tackle social disadvantage. That's important. The second one, of course, is climate change and sustainability, and the ability of our cities to really do things about air quality or really do things about carbon emissions. But I want to come back, in a sense, to the point I was trying to make earlier on about the UK system of cities perhaps having a series of subsystems within it. And at a very simple level, we could say that, you know, it's very important that Manchester and Glasgow and Birmingham and Bristol and Cardiff start to develop some of the attributes of these new world cities. They're metropolitan areas of less than 5 million people. They have world-class universities. They have the ability to specialise in one or two or three newly globalising sectors, whether it's advanced engineering in Glasgow, or it's material science in Manchester, or it's aviation and semiconductors in Cardiff and Bristol, or whether it's, you know, the new generation of autonomous vehicles in Birmingham and in the West Midlands. We need, in this new industrial strategy that the British government is developing, to think about how these places become competitive cities through this industrial strategy, so that they can join the likes of the Tel Avivs and the San Diegos and the Melbournes and the Sydneys in that kind of contest. And at the same time, we need to think again about their complementarity and their connectivity with London, which, as Tim says very clearly, you know, although it would be easy to be depressed about London's prospects through the uncertainty of the Brexit process, actually there's enough here in London, not least 55 higher education institutions, for us to know that this is a city with an amazing future that has to be explored and shaped and developed. So we also have to have a policy that looks at London's systemic relationships with these other places. Part of that is responsible of national government, But it's also, I think, a responsibility of these newly empowered metro mayors elsewhere and the Mayor of London and his or her team to figure out how to make more of those working relationships and not to mediate always the relationship between cities through the junction box of the nation state.
Excellent. My guests today have been Greg Clark and Tim Moonan. Thanks very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.